the M. And, you know, the M is the main shape for HCE, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, in Finnegan's Wake. Joyce had the M, but he would rotate it. It would become an E or a W or a backwards E. But he rotated the M, and that was a symbol for the main character.
Yes, so these logos, these corporation identities are or new literacy, the symbolic literacy, like
the new grammar, the new communication media, the new languages, he called it, which require new grammars.
Yes, and did you see these icons and logos? And they trigger a lot of things in your mind, and it's just
they hold the society together. Is somebody else trying to say something? Anyways, that's why the sports arenas are, you know, riddled with icons from the different companies. They're all trying to become part of what they call branding, part of the Esperanto, the social mortar. What are you laughing about? Yeah? Are you communicating something, caveman? Okay, so yes. So yeah, the branding is the new Esperanto, and it's like Zappa once saying, the media is all there is for social unity. It is the ability to be an icon in the mix there. And, of course, that is getting really weak now with the fragmentation, virtualization of everybody into their own ability to make their own brand.
Yes, and there are so many that you are flooded in this ocean of icons and logos.
Yeah. Okay, and like, sounds. We tend to think of it visually, but there's a sound. Music, and McClune said music is what holds the world together now. He said that 50 years ago.
There's a lot of communication, for example, with the stickers. Like you say, everybody's making their brand, and they put these stickers everywhere, for example, in the lights, street lights. Or.
That's right. They sticker things. They own it by sticking their little... personalized medium on the environment. So let me read you the little McLuhan essay that's included in this edition of the Do Line and see how it relates to what we've just been saying. Because that is the issue that McLuhan is addressing, what we're describing. And it's all the more normal, understandable today, largely because it's obsolete. And also I would say, this increased pattern recognition of the 70s led to people consulting reviews more, and then that led to Siskel and Ebert and those review kind of shows. That's where the critic took over from the artist, because they could offer rapid pattern recognition for the consumer of the information environment. So that's, of course, they all died. They've come and gone now, and they're obsolete, so they died. You know, Siskel and Ebert, one of them died recently. I don't know if they're both dead. So I want to read this. I'm going to mute everybody and read this.
All participants are now muted. All participants are now muted. All participants are now unmuted.
Rapid pattern recognition ever.
Right, right. We say, and McClellan said the student, the teacher is there to save time. We save a lot of time. We get rid of time.
Yes,
you know, same time we get rid of time.
You're summarizing everything since the fall.
Say that again. We are what?
We're summarizing everything, all the connections,
yes,
the patterns, training, since the fall to the now.
That's right. The whole thing that Finnegan's Wake tried to do, we stand
in the chart.
It's in the chart. That's right. It's even in my chart. They put in the Bible because it was so comprehensive. It was so included everything. It, old John, the Revelator, he just had to throw it in.
The only from the fallen estate that is going to survive.
Right. Okay. Which is what It's what I used to say the chart was for. I said, this is Bob's attempt to communicate to the ET known as Dr. Dean. As Dr. Dean took over, this was the archive of the men that she should remember when she gets a break. Here's who was our best shot. They're all tragedies. They're all Shakespearean tragedies, but we made a great effort. And so we handed over the last will and testament of the male species to Carolyn via my chart. Okay, so let me just mute and read this.
All participants are now muted.
The same fucking thing, as he already said. So he's got a circle over his name, I ear, in a circle, by Marshall McLuhan. The present crisis for contemporary Western man is largely the result of an identity gap during a period of transformation from hardware to software service environments. The self-image that man can form when visually located in a job and town is completely irrelevant to the sort of image demanded by such service environments as those created by the jet. In other words, a circulating population offers no static geographic roots as a basis for identity or role in the global theater. The truth in the old observation that the TV child is, at three, much further intellectually developed, is due to his induction into every area of the global theater. Some of his impatient sophistication is currently manifested in the student activist maneuvers of primary and preschool children and the destruction of 19th century hardware environments, in brackets called schools. One instance of grade schoolers enacting the same drama has already been recorded in the press. So apparently 5-year-olds were starting to form their own activist maneuvers. Forget Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and Tim Leary. We got 5-year-olds. Well, of course, we never heard about them, but McLuhan was looking for those examples. Later there was this thing called Children's Liberation showed up. So then the next paragraph. The old hardware environment favored visually organized specialist tasks, which made self-image creation relatively simple and speedy. When, on the other hand, goals are moving as rapidly as those who seek them, private quests cease to avail as means of establishing images of identity. Private quests cease or fail to avail, make available, a means of establishing images of identity. The old private identity image of the civilized individual formed by the Greco-Roman pattern of culture was sturdy if narrow. Civilized men of this Greco-Roman pattern Civilized men, measured against the sensitivity and awareness of Orientals or Eskimos, are limited and callous. Civilized men are limited and callous. Their exclusive and limited range of conscious awareness fostered a very rich and anarchic subconscious life. The subconscious was created by visual space, by civilized men. By comparison, the Oriental, corporate tribal person had immediate conscious access to what we call the Jungian unconscious. The Jungian unconscious in quotes. His private psyche was a very, his private psyche was a very precarious image since it was entirely subordinate to the kinship patterns of corporate involvement. At the same time, the whole corporate patterns could easily be seriously marred or even shattered by the defection or treachery of any member of the group. In brackets, loss of face, unbracket. Loss of face for an entire society can result from the misbehavior of any of its members. This is a tribal society. This is, of course, a common feature of big business life in the corporate organization of today. The Pueblo episode, we talked about that last issue, the Pueblo episode brought the U.S. Navy into jeopardy. As the Navy attempted to, quote, recover face, unquote, through the investigation which followed the recovery of the Pueblo, the, quote, seamless web of circumstance, unquote, that constitutes private and corporate identities was played out as if in a Shakespearean history play with its rich medieval resonance. The Navy is like a segment of the feudal system. Its personnel have roles, in brackets, not jobs, based on a corporate loyalty. The entire episode illustrates allegorically the inherent clash between the 19th century hardware and 20th century hardware. That is, the whole technical operation was 19th century oriented in a 20th century context. But the real dramatic event was the encounter between this outmoded structure and an Oriental culture based on an entirely different identity pattern. The, quote, violation or unquote, the, quote, violation, unquote, of their territory, which was supposed to have occurred, the violation of their territory, which was supposed to have occurred, demonstrates a totally different feeling for space on their part from anything known to or recognized by Western man. I read that again. The violation of the Oriental territory, which was supposed to have occurred, demonstrates a totally different feeling for space on their part from anything known to or recognized by Western man. Sacral space, that's tribal space, sacral space has no relation to geography. It is the space in which people have a sense of total involvement rather than a space to which they attach a legal claim, like property. So, that's the...
All participants are now unmuted.
By McLuhan.
I was thinking how most of the little men, most of the cabals out there, the information they get from the environment is like very low resolution. They eat the TV, the pop music, the fast food.
Yeah.
And of course they take this medication because what they eat in is so low resolution. Their patterns.
Yeah. That's right, no magnesium.
Yeah, there must be a crisis.
Well, I think there was a crisis. The humans lost. There was a crisis and humanity lost. That's what you read in Croker, written 25 years ago. The chemical body gave up.
That's why there's going to be, already happening this mass exodus.
Right.
It's like, what's the point to eat all this shit?
Right, and Croker called it the flesh was weak. The flesh is weak. You know, here, I'm not going to read the Barry Nevitt, that's too big, but the essay by Tony Swartz, it says a sound essay, so it was probably a recording. It's just a couple of pages. I want to read what his contribution was. And it's called The Sight of Sound... and the sound of sight. So there's the synesthesia that McLuhan talks about. So this is section 3 of volume 1, number 9, March 69 of the McLuhan Dew Line. The sight of sound and the sound of sight. And it has an image of maybe a fingerprint kind of thing. Yeah, it's sort of like the visual fingerprint. So it says, the sight of sound. Each medium conveys a message differently, or even a different message. Please read the following three paragraphs and try to think of the type of people who may have said them. You might even try to think of specific people. After reading these, you will be able to hear these specific comments on the enclosed record. I think that it's an interesting way to feel the two media. So the first first quote is, he would walk a mile to make peace with somebody, you know, just like in an uprising somewhere. He was always, if he got word, he would always go and make peace for everybody, get everybody pleased on both sides. People at first, some of them would disagree, but in the end, he would win out. That's why I said if we had a president today like Lincoln was, I don't think it would be all this excitement. I really don't. So, yeah, I remember reading this before. Maybe McLuhan had it in an earlier issue. That's what Lincoln did. Then, quote number 2, I'm inclined to do what I do, perhaps because of environmental conditions in the past, influences that I've been subjected to. It's probably a combination of necessity and inclination. I took up music in a formal manner, in a classic tradition, and so I have the blending of the primitive and the very ultra-classical tradition, and I don't find the joining of the two to be incongruous at all. And it doesn't say who said that. Probably some composer. 3, the third quote. I like to earn money, sort of. When people ask me to earn money, when anybody asks me to earn money, I accept it because I like to get more money. When I'm very low on money and somebody asks me if I should and somebody asks me to do a commercial, I really accept it because I like to get money. And I'm not so money crazy, but it's just the fun of doing a commercial that I like about it. And then there was a fourth comment. This is what we hear at the end of the record. Quote, you'll never forget him. You'll find yourself thinking of him at odd times. You'll say something, you'll think something, and you'll think of Grandpa. You'll see, because I do that with Cheryl or Shirley, I do that about Barney and about my mother. And when I think of them, I feel grief that they're not here. It's a long time. So don't feel guilty, because it's a normal, natural thing. So then there's a picture of a page of a phone book. And there's a quote by Tony Schwartz. Phone books, not children, should be seen and not heard. Phone books, not children, should be seen and not heard. And then it has a picture of a profile of a face with the ear superimposed over the eye, which was the, I think it was Man Ray did a portrait of James Joyce like that. The eye superimposed over, the ear superimposed over one of the eyes. And it's a profile of the face. You see the nose and the other eyebrow. And it says, the sound of sight, the sight of sound, the sound of sight, the sight of sound. That's repeated 1,000 times on the page. And that's the end of Tony Schwartz's contribution. So Tony Schwartz provided a record.
All right.
What?
It's Australopithecus. He's painting his
case. You're telling me who said that quote?
Yeah, no. The Neandertal man just finished his bison, and he was so happy he just went, whoa.
I don't get who you're naming. You're speaking too close to your phone, your mic, I think. What is it? Who's the person?
The caveman.
Oh, the caveman. Okay, so what did you say about the caveman?
He just finished painting his cave.
He's
in ecstasy.
Now, are you talking about me reading this stuff? That's me painting my cave, or McLuhan doing it, or Tony Schwartz? Who's painting their cave metaphorically?
The man who is laughing.
The person. In the
background, yes. The voice. Yes, the nuisance voice.
But we can apply to all of us.
Yeah, he's in ecstasy.
How this the taking the money, making that.
Yes, that quote.
I was thinking about how the tonality we have makes us think we need money to create and have. And we're in a universe where the most thing there is energy. So there is abundance forever. And we think we are in lack. So do you think this new perception obsoletes money? That's why Coldplay... new currency?
The Andor meme obsolesced money, but it didn't have a solution to the issue. I'm thinking that the money, the reason people think they can't do anything without money is that money contains the wealth of the society. It's sped up transactions. If you didn't have money, you'd have to go down the street, grow some carrots, and give some guy a bunch of carrots so he'd give you the bananas, and then you take the peels, and you'd cook the peels and sell the peel as a high. You realize how things are slow without money? Money speeds up things. So people, they don't want to go back and reinvent the wheel. So it says, I'm not going to go back and reinvent everything. Give me half of the shit, and I need money to buy half of that crap from the past so I can build my new environment. That was my instant explanation of money right now. That's why people think that...
Because we are reeducating, we're going to make a net to reeducate. I found it very interesting that the thing most of us want, which is wealth and health, is not recognized by non-physical.
Yeah, isn't that neat? Yes, because non-physical says there never is a problem. Non-physical, since it has the best environment, you know, that the quote McLuhan has, the spider says to the fly, you know, come into my parlor, but he updated it. The computer says to the specialist, come into my parlor. Well, Ion is the guff, right? That's an ecstatic environment. He's like Hugh Hefner. He says, come on in my environment. We'll give you the 52 virgins, the sex goddesses, and the church subgenius. Come into my place, and you'll have bliss. That's the seduction of the guff. And from that point of view, we all should off ourselves and go where the guff is. Ayn sees everything from that perspective.
I was reading an article in which they say China is in the situation of America in 1929.
Yeah.
And it's good to know this. It's like, don't panic, yeah. Greeks, Chinese of the world.
Well, we talked to the Ion about that the other day. I can't play it, but there's a big problem coming to China. It's, in other words, China was visual space. They took over the 20th century and they owned everything, but now ownership is obsolete. And they got to deal with the same crisis your homeless has to deal with. It's the first shall be last, and the last shall be first, as a famous prose writer of aphorisms once said. Some guy in a thing called the Bible.
Hey, Bob. At the beginning, when you were reading Identity Gap, was that your comment about subconscious was created by visual space?
Yes, but that's what he said. I'll read it again. I translated that, but he's saying that. He's saying the subconscious, and there's two subconscious. In Gumbergowski, there's the archetypes of the individual postures of the individual. The literate individual develops all these repressions as it survives in the new information overflow of the printing press and all other printed kinds of social organization 300-400 years ago. So they develop different postures of the mind, and they become part of the unconscious. What Joyce did is that he laid out the collective archetypes of the unconscious, which were the machinic environments themselves. So printing press, as a machinic unconscious, created the idea of the visual psychological unconscious. And it was released in the 20th century during the orgy of all the multiple activities of the private postures of an individual were just obliterated in the 20th century. So I'll replay that. He says, where was that? Just a second. Was it here? Where did it say Jungian unconscious? I saw that. It was in quotes. Well, I'll just read it. It says, the present crisis for contemporary Western man is largely the result of an identity gap during a period of transformation from hardware to software service environments. The self-image that man can form when visually located in a job in town is completely irrelevant to the sort of image demanded by such service environments as those created by the jet. In other words, the circulating population offers no static geographic roots as a basis for identity or role in the global theater. The old hardware environment favored visually organized specialist tasks, which made self-image creation relatively simple and speedy. When, on the other hand, goals are moving as rapidly as those who seek them, private quests cease to avail as means of establishing images of identity. The old private identity image of the civilized individual formed by the Greco-Roman pattern of culture was sturdy if narrow. Civilized men, now listen to this, measured against the sensitivity and awareness of Orientals or Eskimos are limited and callous. Because civilized man has developed the unconscious, the subconscious, that's because he can't be totally holistically sensitive because he's embedded in the eyeball and its extension. So he has considerable less sensitivity and awareness than the tactile preliterate person. So the civilized man always appears limited and callous to the holistic preliterate person. The civilized man's exclusive and limited range of conscious awareness fostered a very rich and anarchic subconscious life, you know, released during sleep, during dreaming. By comparison, the Oriental or corporate tribal person had immediate conscious access to what we call the Jungian unconscious. It didn't fall asleep. It did not go into an eye-numb situation. So it didn't have a private psyche. So the temporary semi-private psyche that a tribal person has is a very precarious image, since it was entirely subordinate to the kinship patterns of corporate involvement. You know, if you blew it with the crowd, you were in trouble. and with the group, you'd lose face. At the same time, the whole corporate patterns could easily be seriously marred or even shattered by the defection or treachery of any member of the group. You see that in a lot of TV shows and political scandals or in political parties. They all got to follow the party line. That's tribalism, neo-tribalism. You get that, Bert?
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, when the
tribal statement.
That's right.
Say goodbye.
Now, the private individual gets on a coach and lays out in front of the psychiatrist, and he feels holistic because he's not standing up and maintaining his two-eyed view. He becomes a cyclops going inner and looking at his dream on the couch. That was the erosion of the private subconscious. But because it was obsolete, everybody thought they were learning about the unconscious through Freudian patterns. But the thing surfaced as a ooze because it wasn't relevant to the collective electric consciousness.
And then we learn all these false premises.
Say it again?
Then we learn all these false premises, the subconscious,
right,
the dreaming.
Right, and then the Jungian moved into, Jung moved to larger archetypal patterns. He moved beyond the private postures of an individual Western man to retrieving iconic archetypes. And that was the last gasp of activity in the skull. So the Jungian unconscious missed that the real unconscious was the technological environments and their logical evolution. That was the true unconscious discovered by Lewis, Joyce, and McLuhan. And, you know, your psychologists don't know this. Your consultants,
yes, like,
know it.
How do you make a psychoanalysis of the Android meme and TVs being watched,
right,
by videotape recorders? I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's the awareness, the consciousness, the information of humanity. Collective.
Right. So, you know, what's good about McLuhan is he spells it out step by step, the early awareness that everybody was forced to deal with later. I mean, people don't know, they don't know how to articulate that the environment molded them into the heebie-jeebie quadriphenic asshole they are today, you know. They don't know how they became that way.
Thanks a lot for the ad. Thanks.
Yes,
for the
cave woman. The cave woman must go back out and continue hunting. Good luck in your hunt.
No, I have to make some fire. I have to keep the cave warm.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Keep the home fires burning. Okay, we'll talk to you later. Thanks for contributing.
Take care,
okay,
man.
Goodbye. All right, so so we did that. Now we'll have to we have to wait till Roxana doesn't have to go to work or play whatever it is wherever these fires are, till she's over for a while. Then we can review the notes. So we're falling behind the notes, but I want to do it with her because she she's into this stuff. She has ideas immediately. The rest of you fall asleep or something. Go into your Jungian unconscious. Uh-oh, I detect we're going into the Bob portion of the show. The knives are out. The satire begins. The insults start to roll out.
Now, but Bob, the, okay. It was the tactility described, and in the end you said that change is the only constant. That is what Ion brings when we engage them, because they're always changing.
Yes.
Everything that we bring to them. So it's like that environment of engaging them. I see where that McLuhan, you could say another point that McLuhan was prophesizing Ion, because this environment speaking to us and bringing our questions, no matter what it is, how they throw it back at you with words to get you to, like Laroxy said, develop your own way of patterning or seeing things. It's just... it's phenomenal.
It's this, this is where Ion is an art form, a global theater for the mouth, you know, in a medium where the mouth can cheaply get to everybody. You just have to tune in and listen. So you get this massage, and Ion is constantly massaging and being a role model or a symbolic representation of the process of the Android meme you're living in.
Yes.
He's miming the environment that we've been in. And that's why he'll say, media ecology speaking, quadrophenia. He'll use my terms technically because that's what he's miming. Or they are miming the with the cheapest medium and, as McLuhan said, the cheapest drug, speech, and making the whole process of the global village archetypal cliche retrievals, miming it right at you personally, one-on-one, with the speed, the depth, the shifting, showing the words are not stable. And then that shows you the post-word rapidity of the Sargasso Sea of debris that you're swimming in. That's what you're trying to say, Bert.
Yes, and that they're literal when they throw the words at us. And
yes.
So when we throw words, or he throw words at me, and then I'd listen to the words, and I'm like, okay, that's not, like, they always say, when I say so, and they said, they have a response to so, but it's not what my my reference is so. So it's a fun play. It's a massage.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, why does Ion say that? When we say so, they say needle pulling thread. Like, what does that phrase mean?
That's a so pun mean. On S-E-W. You're saying S-O, and he's saying S-E-W. Ion is always showing you. You know, he's always showing you the multiple levels of words, which is what McLuhan started spelling out. And he learned that from Joyce and Pound. That's what their poetry was about. Not about ideas, but about words as multifaceted environments with many meanings. And that was starting to become part of ordinary awareness because they'd moved out of the limited mono level that books had created. Books made you think things had one meaning. If you were a little more literate, sophisticated, you'd look up words in the dictionary. But it made a very surface level, flat level of consciousness. The depth of acoustic space was retrieved, in the electric environment. Multiple meanings, philology. So, Ion always started with the medium as the massage. The first thing he told people was your words affect you and everything else around you. The first medium, one of the earliest media, is speech. And he applied a McLuhan-esque approach to it. He says, hey, you're not aware of what your speech is doing to you or to others or to your outer kingdom. He was making you aware of the environment, which was the earliest way you would introduce media ecology, whereas McLuhan was a later stage saying, hey, we bring in TV into the society, it's going to cause changes. We bring in computers, it's going to cause changes. But Ion, since it wanted to wrap it up, complete everything, began at the beginning by saying, the first rule here is your speech is a massage. And then Ion uses speech to mirror it back to you. And always got you, Bashar or any medium get you to look up words in the dictionary? No, nobody does that. There's not enough time, and it's too literate for the semi-oral tactile heebie-jeebies of our time. You know what I mean? They're not going to look up a word. Here's Ion being an old-fashioned grammarian, but he was always doing it to show you the multiple levels of words. Right? It's pretty didactic, pretty old-fashioned, like a British school system.
Right.
For a pop culture phenomenon. Yeah? What?
Right. So when we speak, we should always be aware of the multiple or other meanings that our words have, not just the one.
Right.
Where
and also that they are things. When Bert said something about, words or objects or things, that was the tribal awareness McLuhan pointed out at the beginning. For a literate man, words are not things. They're abstract images. But for a tribal man, words are things and cause havoc. So they're very ecological with words. And, that's what political correctness was. That was a dim, literate population, semi-literate, realizing, maybe we shouldn't say words. We should be aware of their effects. and that's why it was shocking for old-timers to have to deal with that, because they didn't have to think of words that way. They were literate newspaper-reading people. But when you got into the fact that media were communicating all over the globe to all kinds of different audiences, you had to... let's say that the electronic global village made people aware of their words. And that brought in what was called political correctness.
But there's people, there's others who enjoy hearing people who are not politically correct, who are politically incorrect.
Well, okay.
And
because the computer creates the caveman, the cyclops, who doesn't have to be connected to any other chemical bodies because all his needs are taken care of by environments that he's the king or queen of. So, yes, there is. Mass man is not tribal. Certain older media like to say McLuhan retrieved tribal awareness. He's no way. I retrieved mass man, which is a tactile interplay between quadrophenia of a tribal person and a private person, and a solitary person and a post-angelic person. So as the digital Andromedan propped up each individual more and more, you have individuals becoming cyclops and insulting everybody on their opinion commentaries, on chat lines. But the manipian satire caused by the individual communicant increased in the latter stages of the TV era. That's the Jerry Springer show. And then jumped into the digital era with Web 1.0. So you see, we are not tribal, we're not individual, we're at least four factors. And it's best simply done by four bodies. And then the Android beam imitates those four bodies, so it's the fifth body and it's mirroring you, and then you have the mystery body coming in. See?
Yeah.
Why do you laugh? You're laughing at the insights you're getting?
Yeah, I said, wow. Because
you see
that
how
wouldn't be
people,
the normal. The Go ahead.
Yeah, people think in very crude caveman clumps of grunts. I'm an American, and I'm this, and I'm that. And they're talking about this old, gone chemical body at best, if they're talking about anything. They're actually quadrophenic, and they don't realize it. And so it's easy to defend your iconic chemical body status as a cover for the fact you're failing to deal with your own quadrophenia. And that's what all of wealth is built on. Wealth is all these newspapers, magazines, and talk shows, and political elections, and advertising, all these iconic media is there to prop up your old body. And that's trillions of dollars made in the circulation of those anesthetics, those drugs, those medications. The environments are medications.
Hmm. So then most of the medical treatment is gauged on the people who are suffering from quadrophenia.
Yes.
With all these different environments.
That's what I was trying
now.
To say. My brilliant thing with Roxy that badly recorded, but if you listen to it closely, I'm saying we're not dealing with our multiple environments. When you go to a doctor, you're making the mistake of a guy who's only looking at your chemical body.
Yeah.
And overdoing the measurement of it because he doesn't know about the other bodies. So they exaggerate every little thing, and as Carolyn would say, you go to the doctor's office, they're going to find something wrong with you. Because they're having an identity crisis in their own role of trying to have purpose. So they do overkill just like the private death squads do. Everybody's engaged in overkill.
Yeah, that's so true.
We do overkill by having an 18-hour show. But we have an alibi. We know we're going to live forever, so we're creating content for when you're living in eternity, consciously. It's going to be a lot of complaints. There, in 50 years, 60, 100 years, everybody's saying, that fucking Bobby only did a show 18 hours. I've listened to all 18 hours, 2,000 fucking shows three times, and there's no more material. What are we going to do? Oh, Bob's still around. He just went, he went AWOL. He went stealth. He'll show up. He'll fill in the need. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I should, now, McLuhan is so simple. It's interesting, Bert. You have to realize, when people read this back then, they didn't understand it. They thought this guy was an incomprehensible genius. And it's fucking baby talk now, to me. So let's just grab Baudrillard and grab some online here and read some of his McLuhanism, but suitably more complex for the 80s. Let's see.
I wanted to ask just one more question on the part that you left off, not the last part, but the part before the last part. When you were talking about packaging and imaging, in today's society, is packaging and imaging products, is it as important as it was when this was written about?
Well, it's like I would say, it's all relative. You got different phases of society and people living at different phase shifts. You know, there are 16, 17-year-old people who were successful business people, judges, doctors, maybe they're 70s and 80s, and they do not have a clue what's going on today, but they think in those old terms, and they still define that, their life like that. So there's that group of people who are stuck in their phase, and it's almost like in my chart I have different phases, and you might talk to them, they'll say, well, it's all about presenting yourself as a package. They don't know the word process, but they might begin to, the smarter one of the 80-year-olds say, yeah, well, it's a process. You know, they'll use the word package versus process, which was the jargon of the 60s, 70s, and that's too slow for the 22-year-old. What do they talk about? Brand marketing. When we talk to Chad, you know, the guy who runs our website, and he gets into how we should up our. He'll do a conference on with Ginny on how to market our products, and it's very complex talk. You know what I mean? They get into these graphs and charts and jargon, and this is done by 25-year-olds, so to speak, that work for Chad. You know, you have to be so, and these kids think this way. They're very complicated and swift with it.
Yeah,
you know,
I know a lot of kids who are really taken by the packaging and imaging of a product. Like, they would talk about the quality first, and then right away they would go to how it's packaged and how it feels and how it, you know, the image of it. They go.
Okay, listen to this. Let's update that. You know, you've heard me say, for the Eskimo or the Inuit, they call them now. Even after, you're not allowed to use the word Eskimo, I think, up in Canada. That's politically incorrect. That was white man's name for the tribal people in the Arctic. So it's Inuit or something. I think it's Inuit. I don't process Canadian hologramic information, so I'm out of date on it. But anyways, they see 50 kinds of snow, right? You go up there, you just see white stuff, and it's a nuisance. But the Eskimo Inuit can see through all the subtleties. That's what these kids, they grow up in a quadriphenic multimedia environment. They see 50 kinds of packaging that an old baby boomer would say, well, that's all fucking surface hypocrisy. Who gives a fuck about what the book looks like? It's what the substance of the book. You know, you don't judge the man by his clothes. Well, these kids do, because they're looking at four bodies, not just the chemical body. You must judge the chip body by its clothes. There's a new axiom. Yes, don't judge a man by his clothes. But, oh, you definitely do that when you do the chip body. I mean, that's why people get themselves touched up for their chip body image, right?
Yeah.
And you get people like Kate up in Vancouver who meets some of these people that she has flashy lives with online and meets them that are dull thuds in the chemical body. So here's an example. This is 30 years ago. This is Baudrillard describing the medium as a message in his language, which he wrote in the late 70s, and it became, you know, classroom truth in sociology in the 80s and 90s. He talks about the four stages of simulation. And what that means, four stages of media sophistication. So listen to this. The first stage is a faithful image/copy, where we believe, and it may even be correct, that a sign is a reflection of a profound reality. This is a good appearance in what Baudrillard called the sacramental order. The second stage is perversion of reality. This is where we come to believe the sign to be an unfaithful copy, which masks and denatures reality as an evil appearance. It is of the order of maleficence. Here, signs and images do not faithfully reveal reality to us, but can hint at the existence of an obscure reality which the sign itself is incapable of encapsulating. The third stage masks the absence of a profound reality, where the simulacrum pretends to be a faithful copy, but it is a copy with no original. Signs and images claim to represent something real, but no representation is taking place, and arbitrary images are merely suggested as things which they have no relationship to. Baudrillard calls this the order of sorcery, a regime of semantic algebra where all human meaning is conjured artificially to appear as a reference to the increasingly hermetic truth. So that's a description of the Reagan era. Then the fourth stage is pure simulation, in which the simulacrum has no relationship to any reality whatsoever. That's the Android meme, taking on a life of its own. Here, signs merely reflect other signs, and any claim to reality on the part of images or signs is only of the order of other such claims. This is a regime of total equivalency, where cultural products need no longer even pretend to be real in a naive sense, because the experiences of consumers' lives are so predominantly artificial that even claims to reality are expected to be phrased in artificial, hyper-real terms. Any naive pretension to reality as such is perceived as bereft of critical self-awareness and thus as over-sentimental. Now that's the kind of fucking complexity of McLuhan stuff that happens by the 80s.
What was the third description?
I'll do them again.
Okay.
I'm going to do them again. The first simulation is the 400 years ago. An image copy, a book. It's a copy, and you can make another copy, and they look alike. That shocked tribal people. What? Something looked the same? You know what I mean? They couldn't believe that you could make something look like another thing. So that's the first stage of simulation 400 years ago. So it's called the first stage of the faithful image/copy, where we believe, and it may even be correct what you believe, that a sign, so the book is a sign, is a reflection of a profound reality. The book is a reflection of the author's thoughts. This is a good appearance in what Baudrillard called the sacramental order. So like religion was still strong 400 years ago. So there was a sacramental level to visual space. So then you come to the next level, which would be, let's say, the 19th century with the photograph. All right, the beginning of early post-literate, post-book media. This is called the perversion of reality. Okay, so you get a photograph. It looks like reality, but it isn't. But it looks just like it. The second stage is a perversion of reality. This is where we come to believe the sign, the photograph, to be an unfaithful copy, which masks and denatures reality as an evil appearance. It is of the order of maleficence. Here, signs and images do not faithfully reveal reality to us, but can hint at the existence of an obscure reality which the sign or photo itself is incapable of encapsulating. Now, the point there is that the literate person in the 19th century can't totally adapt to the reality of the photograph. Doesn't seem important. That's why they didn't think movies were important. It was just mere entertainment. They didn't know it was new realities. They still saw the book, the sacramental order, as the prime reflection and copy of reality. When you start getting the newer media, it throws a wrench into the sacred order of the print. All right? So you get that point?
Yes.
Yeah, because they've been reading the book, and they knew about the book for so long that
right.
They weren't...
All of a sudden you got a picture, which, why read a description of a book, 3 pages to see the description of the landscape, when you have an instant photograph? That photograph is amazing, but it's new. It seems tenuous. It just can't be so real as this book that I'm used to getting my descriptions from. So then we get to, let's say, the TV age, which is a living simulation, live, ongoing, that is replacing the photograph and the book. It's something that's pressuring you. So that's called the simulacrum. So here's what he calls it. Here's how he defines it. The third stage masks the absence of a profound reality, where the simulacrum pretends to be a faithful copy. you know, you watch the news, and anybody nowadays can say, well, the news is distorted. But it is a copy with no original. Once you have the electric on going 24/7, you don't know what the original was. Signs and images claim to represent something real, but no representation is taking place, and arbitrary images are merely suggested as things which they have no relationships to. Baudrillard calls this the order of sorcery. The order of sorcery. So when TV comes in the 50s, 60s, people start to feel profoundly alienated that something's being manipulated on them that they can't keep up with. The simulation has got out of hand and seems to be a sorcery. A regime of semantic algebra where all human meaning is conjured artificially to appear as a reference to the increasingly hermetic truth or the book truth. So it's like a Jeopardy or a game show. It's an ongoing reality that seems phony compared to book knowledge. All right? So then he gets to the fourth stage, which is the Android meme, where the simulation becomes alive and takes on a life of its own. See if you can fit that idea into what I read. The fourth stage is pure simulation, in which the simulacrum has no relationship to any reality whatsoever, right? To any chemical body reality. Here, signs merely reflect other signs, so the different parts of the Android meme are talking to each other, and any claim to reality on the part of images or signs is only of the order of other such claims. In other words, none of the imagery that's talking to each other wants to have anything to do with reality, and if you start bringing up reality, you're fucking put in jail. This is a regime of total equivalency. That means like everything's replaceable into anything else, where cultural products need no longer even pretend to be real in a naive sense, because the experiences of consumers' lives are so predominantly artificial, from the literate point of view, that even claims to reality are expected to be phrased in artificial, hyper-real terms. Any naive pretension to reality as such is perceived as bereft of critical self-awareness, and thus as over-sentimental. That's why the neoconservatives came in the 80s and 90s and said, we're teaching our college kids that there's no truth. That's ridiculous. There is truth, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's the old literate guys trying to bring back the old neoconservative visual space values of classical individualism and hates government. And they consider the postmodernists, the TV baby boomers and Generation X's that are teaching this stuff, is to be very corrupt because they're not admitting there's any truth in anything. So, I don't mean you to get everything I'm saying, but it's just to show you the complexity of media analysis compared to the simple stuff we're reading in McLuhan. Now, here's it continues here. What I just said about each level, it gives the history. Listen to this. There are three types of simulacra and identifies each with a historical period. So the first one I read, the first order associated with the pre-modern period, where representation is clearly an artificial place marker for the real item. The uniqueness of objects and situation marks them as irreproducibly real, and signification obviously gropes towards this reality. Then it says the second order, associated with the modernity of the Industrial Revolution, so 19th century, where distinctions between representation and reality break down to the proliferation of mass reproducible copies of items, turning them into commodities. The commodity's ability to imitate reality threatens to replace the authority of the original version, printing press, because the copy is just as real as its prototype. The third order, associated with the postmodernity of late capitalism, where the simulacrum precedes the original, it happens before the original, and the distinction between reality and representation vanishes. There is only the simulacrum, and originality becomes a totally meaningless concept, thus getting towards the Android meme level. Then it goes into a little more complexity. Baudrillard theorizes that the lack of distinctions between reality and simulacra originates in several phenomena. One, contemporary media, including television, film, print, and the internet, which are responsible for blurring the line between products that are needed in order to live a life and products for which a need is created by commercial images. Two, exchange value, in which the value of goods is based on money, literally denominated fiat currency, rather than usefulness. And moreover, usefulness comes to be quantified and defined in monetary terms in order to assist exchange. Three, multinational capitalism, which separates produced goods from the plants, minerals, and other original materials and the processes, including the people and their cultural context, used to create them. Four, urbanization, which separates humans from the non-human world and recenters culture around productive throughput systems so large they cause alienation. 5, language and ideology, in which language increasingly becomes caught up in the production of power relations between social groups, especially when powerful groups institute themselves at least partly in monetary terms. So, I don't expect you to get all that, but you see the complexity that the successor to McLuhan, that's what he was called, see how he's writing? But, you know, you got kids sitting around in classrooms all their life, even more so processing the media in the 60s and 70s. They can take more boredom and more mind masturbation. You take some, some guy who's 65 now, a baby boomer who doesn't understand his kids. He doesn't want to read a book or sit around and analyze some TV show. He doesn't know his kids are analyzing Madonna and TV shows in class, and the father's paying $1,000 so the kid can analyze some fucking TV show in cultural studies classes. You know? That's shocking to a baby boomer, not all baby boomers, but, you know, the working class guy. He doesn't understand what's going on. What education is, he just knows that his kid has to get into college or he doesn't have citizenship. Really, citizenship. Anyway, can you imagine being 23 and you have you dropped out of high school, you fucked off with drugs for a few years, you finally had to get your shit together, you got kicked out of home, and then you had to get a job, so you go work at McDonald's. And you're sitting there at 23 every day. How can they think they're going to do that for the next 70 years? They are not going to do it. They can't. That'd be lead to a lot of unhappiness if that's your prospects, right?
Yeah. That's why many of them want to escape their reality, and they're on meds.
Right, they're on meds. They do part-time work. They don't need much. They live at home. They get fed pizzas. They can get it by and a small amount of money. Maybe they have a car, and they drive around to get their drugs or they're masturbated or whatever the stupid shit they do, you know. Get more hard drives so they can keep on their iPhones and their computer. Like, it's pretty, you just have to think what an old geezer would think of the way kids live today. They are disgustingly, evilly lazy, right?
Yeah.
Because the old guy can't see that there's no environment for those kids to plop themselves into unless they become fanatics at the age of 10 and study for their, whatever they're called, SATs for 5 fucking years and become an idiotic neurotic on medication to get into a good college, which then is stress fucking to the max. And they finally get their gig at Goldman Sachs when they're 25 years old and they last 3 years and then die of a heart attack.
Well, the parents can't understand why their kids are not hard workers as they are. So it just boggles them. They're like, why are
lazy? The parents,
why are you quitting your job?
The parents didn't sit around watching TV and listen to music 24/7 like the younger kids grew up doing. Didn't have that much media. You know what I mean? They watched a couple of TV shows a week back in the 60s or 50s or 70s. Now the kid grows up processing data. And this guy, he made a lot of money on the Internet doing porn on the Internet in Toronto. And he is a great gamer. He's like in his 50s or something. He spends a lot of time doing the game world, which I've never experienced. I saw him do it, but I don't look at it much. I don't know much what it's like. But he's a modern, Bobby Hall had his kids play in the NHL or any of his other great hockey players. Their kids made the NHL. So Gordie Howe got to play with his sons. So what is this guy, this gamer, digital guy who made his money in doing porn shoots, internet porn on the internet? He's taking his genius kid, who's about 11 years old, to a major gaming conference somewhere, New York City or something. This kid's a whiz. He can hang out with the 16-year-olds and the 20-year-olds and keep up with them in the gaming world. That's what this fucking kid. Now, this kid, in my image of him, may not be accurate, but I assume this kid's been at the computer 24/7 for the first 10 years of its life, right? Now it's a super fucking typist or whatever they do there with their fingers, and he now can go and go play with the big boys, the 16-year-olds. So there's the son passing on his skills to the kid. But it's not playing hockey. It's somebody sitting at a console typing, whatever the fuck they call it, clicking.
They use their thumbs a lot, their thumbs and
right.
like whatever gadget they're holding, the remote.
Right. They can move it rapidly.
You're sick, yeah.
Now, if they're lucky, the kid is also goes to good school and plays basketball and can swim and play a piano. I don't know how they fit all this shit into a kid's life. I mean, they're just endlessly being programmed. But his main new talent is that this kid's a whiz in gaming. So
yeah, well, now there's
guy.
A parent who's. There's an old guy who's embraced what his child is doing
yes.
24/7 because
he grew up with
others.
That. He's a Generation Xer who did get into computers early. You know, most Generation Xers didn't. They got cut off. They didn't make it. The next generation, Generation Y, that grew up with computers. Generation Xers are more TV body savvy. They do PR and media relations, blah blah. But this guy, he got into computers early, so he was avant-garde for his generation, right? So he learned it all, and he passed
yeah.
it on to his kid.
Yeah.
So what do you think of that, Bert? Or anybody else who wants to add to this? Oh, Bert, sorry, Bert. I see you fell off. So, Bert, you have a backlog of commentary to make.
So Baudrillard was pretty. He was considered the successor of McLuhan. So his theory or his view was presented in the 80s, part of the 90s.
He started in the late 70s. What I read, he produced in the late 70s, and then Semiotext out of Columbia University French department, Severo Latrange, I've mentioned before. He started publishing. He was French. And came to North America and taught at Columbia. He started publishing Baudrillard and these guys in 83, 84. And those little books really spread French theory all over American academia and everything. It was like McLuhan's little book, The Medium is a Massage. And Severo told me that he modeled it on McLuhan's The Medium is a Massage. He wanted these little paperbacks that people could put in their purse and read on the subway, you know, in New York, you know, at noon hour or on lunch. So it popularized all these guys. And Baudrillard was the one who sort of made it the biggest splash. He became a guru in the art world, and because he was the closest to McLuhan, that was most relevant to the media world of North Americans. The Derrida, the Lyotard, the Deleuze and Guattari, they were more conceptual and European, more geared in philosophy. Baudrillard just discounted everything. It just said, we're living in the Matrix. Now, here's the point. So when the generation, what are the Wachowski brothers? They must be Generation X. When they want to summarize their life, they make a series called The Matrix. Who do they celebrate? Who do they use as their guru? Jean Baudrillard.
Yes,
The
right.
first Matrix
right.
begins. The very first scene, when Neo is sleeping, some guys bang on the door, he opens it, and they're a bunch of disco ducks or something. They're going to a rave, and they need something, a drug or something. So he goes, and he pulls out a book, and the book inside has the chip or whatever it is he's giving them, the drug
yeah,
or whatever,
that's
like,
right.
hidden in the book. The book is
yeah.
the very thing I just read from, Simulation of Simulacra by Baudrillard. That's the book.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's just like how McLuhan would be acknowledged in media in the 60s, 70s. Baudrillard got acknowledged in his generation. And Baudrillard was asked to help write Matrix 2 and 3. And he said, no, you guys are making the Matrix movies the way the Matrix would make it. He objected to that. These guys were such a product of the whole process, they didn't understand as deeply as Baudrillard thought he did of what they were talking about. So then there's the final punchline here. I've told the story before. See if you remember this. Do you remember what the next phase is? Jerry Fialka had a friend at the Midnight Special, whatever the bookstore was in Santa Monica. And he had a friend work there. His friend told him that one day, Keanu Reeves came in. Okay, the guy who plays Neo. Keanu Reeves. And he comes up to the front desk and he says, do you have any books by McLuhan? And they said, sure. And they went and showed him the McLuhan section. So my joke when I heard about that is that Keno Reeves, Baudrillard was part of this script and the scene, but he found out that there was a guy before Baudrillard who had the truth or the pre-Baudrillard stuff. So he now was finding out where the movie came from by going and reading McLuhan.
Good. That was smart of Keno.
Right. It'd be good to get access to him and say, well, how'd it go? Do you understand? What are you doing?
<It went.
laughs> I tell you, I could do the best interviews of all these stars, of all these generations, because I know that Jack Nicholson was studying McLuhan's cliched archetype in the early 70s. He says it in an obscure interview. I could make interesting interviews. I'm just reading about Dylan. I could point out, if I had an interview with Dylan, why did you name Norman Mailer and Marsh McLuhan as the main, you know, historians of the 60s in a Spin magazine interview in 1985? Yeah, you know, and Dylan would say something about it, but I would make the interviews really interesting. I'd cross the generations. I'd bring in the past and the present and the future. You know what I mean? Because I know what these guys were influenced by. But the subsequent generations don't know that. They don't make interesting interviews. They don't know that the liner notes of one of Dylan's earlier albums is about a guy screaming involvement quotes. Well, that was McLuhan. There's Dylan making fun of McLuhan in the 64, 65, whatever the album was, Highway 61 Revisited or the one before that, whatever it was titled. It's early liner notes. And if he was making fun of McLuhan, which I suspect he was, little he realized 20 years later he'd be praising McLuhan. He said, if you want to understand the 60s, read McLuhan. See, that's important cross-generational information I've got.
Yes. Did Baudrillard interact with McLuhan, or he just studied McLuhan?
He never met McLuhan. What he did is he was part of the radical situationists in Paris, the ones that led the riots in Paris, May 68, the famous revolution against De Gaulle. Do you know about that? The May 68.
No.
You see, riots broke out all over the place in May 68 in universities, in Paris, in Colombia, Mexico. You know, Roxy knows the history of what happened to the kids. They were put in jail and killed in 68. In Mexico, it was fucking tough, right? You didn't get far. You could topple the government a little bit in France, but you just became a media sensation in the United States, in New York City. But anyways, so Baudrillard is part of the situationist, and his first writing was a review of McLuhan. I don't know which book, maybe Understanding Media. His first article that he published as a writer was a review in 1967 of McLuhan stuff. So he began with McLuhan.
Hmm.
We could probably find it online and see what he said. But now take this. Who knows that in 1970 when David Bowie came over with his acoustic guitar and long hair... This is, you know, well before Ziggy Stardust and all that. He was a folky kind of guy. He's interviewed in Rolling Stone, and he says in the interview, I'm interested in McLuhan. That's what he said.
Did he also visit Frank Zappa?
Say it again. What did you say? Visit?
Did he also visit Frank Zappa in Laurel Canyon?
David Bowie?
Yeah.
I don't think so. All I know is that Eric Burdon, Jimi Hendrix, and Mick Jagger, and a few other guys older than Bowie visited Zappa. I think Zappa, in 1970, Zappa has broken up the Mothers. He's run his five-year course. And I think Bowie would come out of the bisexual community. And maybe Zappa wasn't that relevant to them. I think Bowie was influenced by Quentin Crisp. You know that guy? The British homosexual who became famous in the 70s by doing a monologue play or something? Quentin Crisp.
No.
And another guy, Lindsay somebody, who was the mime teacher. He was a big influence on Bowie. But how did Bowie say McLuhan? Why did he know about McLuhan? See, that's another case. All these people, Warhol, everybody who becomes famous is influenced by McLuhan. And when I went and saw the Bowie retrospective in the Berlin Museum, when I was there in August 2014, the opening artifact showing Bowie's young life and the world he grew up in the 50s, the first fucking thing you see is McLuhan's Mechanical Bride.
Mm.
Not that he read it, but that it shows the media environment that the young David Bowie, the thesis is, was influenced by, you know, pop culture and advertising and fashion. McLuhan's book shows that environment as it was in the 50s. So this is why Bert should be absolutely astounded at Bob's knowledge, as he often repeats, because it's very heavy what I've come up with, what I can explain. I am the only fucking legitimate fucking course around.